This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's party time at the Hawaii State Capitol. This morning, ceremonies are underway to mark the 50th anniversary of the historic building. Artifacts from a time capsule that was sealed up decades ago are on display. We were there back in December when that capsule was opened by State Archives Director Adam Jensen. No one knew what kind of shape the items would be in, but with the exception of the spools of microfilm, the documents and the photos mostly survive intact. The challenge now, what to save for the next 50 years. Take a listen as we crack open that capsule.
There we go. That's one. We put in a DVD today, we know we're not going to be able to read it in 10 years. I mean, anybody buy a laptop in the last 2 years? Does it even have an optical drive? So what do we do? Do we put one in there knowing that they're not going to be able to read it, yet committing as an archival institution, we'll keep a DVD drive around just for kicks so they can have the fun of pushing the little button and have the coffee holder pull out of the PC and so they can play it. So it's a much greater challenge for us because technology changes so very rapidly now that what we use today will be obsolete in 10 years. So how do we do something that'll last 50 years? And so that's why we're trying to figure out how do we solicit input from the public, from the next generation, what is important today? Because that's really what this is. It's 2 cubic feet of, this is what is relevant to us. This is culture today. This is important. These are societal issues that are really relevant today that in 50 years you might think it's a bygone era. So it may not be readable, but it's important.
Now, the birthday of our state capitol is being marked with a reception in the governor's office starting at 12:30 today, where the artifacts will be on display. You know, every day, visitors from all over come to admire the one-of-a-kind structure. They're impressed that the architecture reflects the islands.
I think that this is a very cool capitol building. I think it's interesting the way that the pillars go up representing the volcanoes. That's amazing to me. It's just a really cool design. And I like any open air space, so the fact that the Capitol building has no roof, has no dome, that's very, very cool to me.
That was Dawn from Los Angeles, California. You know, on Saturday, the Historic Hawaii Foundation hosts a symposium to talk about the Capitol's past and future. We sat down with Don Hibbard, the former head of the State Historic Preservation Office. He calls himself a heritage specialist. We had a conversation as we sat at the rotunda of the Capitol building. Lawmakers actually began talking about a new building back in 1939, and then they started acquiring land around what today is known as our Capitol District. At the time, our territorial government was operating out of Iolani Palace.
I've seen pictures at Iolani Palace when it was in use, and there were all kinds of structures that they had built on the lanais of the palace, and it was just horrible, actually.
Yes, they had enclosed many of the lanai with essentially plywood boxes, which people worked out of. And then also during World War II, the military had built several temporary structures on the grounds, and the legislature started using those as well.
So that had to change.
Yes, that was the idea. And so in 1941, the first priority the Territorial Planning Board said was to buy this land between Miller Street and Richards Street, where part of the Capitol now stands, and that's where they're going to put the Capitol building. And so they were going to ask the legislature for money and get things rolling, but then World War II broke out. And with that, all thoughts of the Capitol stopped. And it's not till after the war, in 1949, the legislature says, yes, let's get rolling, and they appropriated $100,000 for architects to draw up plans for a new Capitol building.
And you had mentioned that there were all kinds of plans.
Yes, over the next 10 years or so, there was just incredible suggestions being made. The architects that were hired were Merrill Sims and Rorick and Vladimir Osipoff and Mr. Heen, and they put together a proposal for a 9-story high-rise, and that would be for the governor's office and for government spaces, and then there's two low-rise buildings on the property, one for the Senate and one for the House. That did not meet good at that time. When they went into the legislature, says, here it is, cost is going to be $5.5 million, because then it was going to be the entire block where the state capitol is now. And so land acquisition and construction, the legislature, too much money, and they don't make a decision. So in 1955, Governor King appoints a committee to review what are we going to do, and the committee recommended, yes, this spot between Hotel and Barataria and Richards and Punchbowl should be the place for the Capitol, but we don't like the high-rise building. It's not appropriate. And so they tell the architects to go back and redesign it.
Go back to the drawing board.
Yes, exactly. So in 1955, again, nothing happens. And the architects go back and they design buildings in what's called a Hawaiian style, with the dicky roofs, with the double pitch hip roof. And so a sprawling design with reflecting pools and a lot of planting on the lot. The governor will be in one building. The House and Senate will be in other buildings. Be a big meeting room in the center. So they present this.
That was take two.
Yes. But in 1957, it wasn't even discussed. Democrats control the legislature at that time, and they start asking, no, this is the wrong spot for the Capitol. And we think it should be somewhere else. And they were suggesting down where Fort Armstrong, at the end of Punchbowl and South Streets, that land is all opening up. Fort Armstrong is returned to the state. And so they wanted to put it down there, essentially where from the Honolulu Harbor all the way over to Kewalo Basin. The legislature started pushing for the area down at the end of Punchbowl and South Street. But then Harold Castle muddles the water more and says, I'll give you 100 acres on the windward side where Hawaii Loa College, Hawaii Pacific University now stand. And he was willing to give that area free to the state, the territory, to build the capital there. And so that's more talking.
Must have had ulterior motives.
Maybe. It would have been something different. He was saying, yeah, once the new Poly Highway is done, 20 minutes to get over. And you can still keep your government offices downtown and da-da-da. And, of course, at this time, too, the downtown merchants are starting to get worried. No, we want government here. And so that's when the Downtown Improvement Association is formed. And so they come out strongly in favor of the present site of the Capitol. And then all sorts of new ideas start popping up. Maui suggests they're located in the middle of the island chain. It should be on Maui. We'll build a new city for a new capital city. They're talking about down where the Symphony Concert Hall is. That land was still open. Let's build the state capitol there. Someone else was saying extend Bishop Street, where Poly Highway is now. Run a big mall up that way. So there's many different suggestions that are coming out. Big uproar. And of course, it gets more complicated. In 1959, President Eisenhower appoints Governor Quinn, governor to Governor King's place. And he has a new planning director. And he eventually comes out, he writes a plan supporting the Fort Armstrong area. And so that goes to the legislature to have that approved. And there's big arguments in the legislature. And then in the closing days of the legislature, in conference, all of a sudden a bill is slipped in saying this area between Barataria and Hotel will be the location of the state capitol. And that passes.
So once the lawmakers determined where they were going to site the capitol, then how was it going to look? Because you said they didn't want the high-rise.
Exactly. So what happened was Governor Quinn appointed a citizens committee of around 15 people headed by Bob Metcalf and Representative Koga. And the committee decided not to have a competition because it would take too long and be too expensive. And instead they decided, we'll just put an ad in the newspaper. Any architects interested in designing the Capitol, let us know. And they also stipulated that any mainland firms must be associated with a local firm. and because local architects were pushing, no, you should have a local architect. They had around 20 people, 25 people respond, a lot of very big name people, Richard Neutra from California, Minoru Yamasaki, he was already in town doing Queen Emma Gardens. I.M. Pei was already here starting to do the East-West Center. Pietro Bellucci, the Dean of Architecture at MIT. So there's many people applying. From New York, Harrison and Abramovitz, who had done Carnegie Center and also the United Nations building.
So impressive talent.
Yes, yes. There were major talent. And, of course, John Carl Warnecke. And they were all teaming up with different local architects. Warnecke went with the firm of Belt, Lamon, and Lowe, which is interesting because actually Lamon, Freeth, and Haynes were architects. Belt is an engineer. He worked for many years in the Public Works Department and then started Belt Collins. And then Lowe is a structural engineer. They teamed up with John Carl Warnecke of San Francisco, and eventually they're picked as the winner. They're interviewed. Takes 2 months to interview everybody, and they said they liked Warnecke's proposal because, number one, the local firms, many local firms are very small, so there's like five or six going together with a mainland firm. But Belt, Lamon, and Lowe had already been working together before, so they liked that. Lamon was already sitting on the City Planning Commission, so he was familiar very much with the whole Civic Center idea. They liked that Warnecke at that time was designing the U.S. Embassy in Thailand, which had water surrounding it. And they liked that idea very much. So all these things came together, and they decided that, yes, this is a team that is capable and will get the job done.
So do you have a favorite architectural feature in this building?
Well, I think what's really makes this building different than just about any other Capitol in the country is that it's so old. And people point out to that right away, openness of the building, and that it's not only responding to our climate, but also to our society, that Hawaii was a very open society.
We are sitting in the rotunda enjoying these lovely trade winds this morning.
Right.
We have a gorgeous day, the sun shining, there are clouds, you know, the palm trees are swaying. It's really a lovely spot.
Yes, yes, you have your Malcolm Mackay view. It's unfortunate now the federal building is blocked part of the Mackay view, but other than that, it's still very much there. And also, not just the openness, but also the galleries. All the offices are on the second, third, and fourth floors, but there's a large lanai. It's all open. The only way representatives and senators can get down to the chambers is interacting in public spaces where the public can see them and talk with them.
As a journalist, that's one of my favorite spots, is that we would hang on the railing and we would watch to see where the power brokers were going. You know, sometimes during reorganization, we would watch them all kind of sneak into somebody's office and we knew something was up. Or if it was a particular deadline, we would just watch to see, oh, there's the governor. He's coming down the lobby for his bill. But so as journalists, we love the openness because we could see what was happening.
Yes, and that was something that was stressed by the advisory committee to Warnecke, that this must be open. It must be accessible to the public. So even now, you have the chambers on both sides, but you just walk, and you can just walk into the doors of the chambers and listen to the legislative sessions. And so that was all part of it. That's part of the democratic spirit, and they wanted that very strongly. The columns on the outside, rising up from the ocean, flare out at the top like palm trees. And so all of that, it captures the spirit of Hawaii in the building itself. You don't need applied ornament to do that. You know, you don't want some fancy, trendy building because it'll become dated. You want a building that will endure. And I think Warnecke did that. He even said, you want a building that in the year 2000 you'll still be proud of. And I think Warnecke has succeeded in doing that with this design.
Here it is, 2019.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Don Hibbert, who will be one of several people talking about the state capitol history at a symposium tomorrow marking the 50th anniversary of the iconic structure. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your Aloha Friday Backyard Quiz. Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolabe, uhamai. In today's backyard quiz, we're looking for Casper the Friendly Crab. One of the common inhabitants of Hawaii's beaches is the ghost crab. These little crabs are sometimes difficult to pinpoint because of their camouflaged white shell and lightning speed. In fact, ghost crabs are among the world's fastest creatures. They can travel 10 times the number of body lengths as a cheetah in the same period of time. One feature in particular sets the ghost crab apart from others in its ability to move in almost every direction, including up. That's right, this crab can jump. Ghost crabs have the impeccable eyesight also because their eyes sit atop stalks protruding from their head. In Hawaii, we have two species of ghost crabs. For today's quiz, can you tell us which two species scurry around our beaches? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programs. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Health, Ulupono Initiative, and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working.
The cloud over the Honolulu City Prosecutor's Office still stormy. State Attorney General Claire Connors is looking into reports that Keith Kaneshiro was back in his office, even though a week ago he announced he was taking paid leave because of a target letter he received from federal investigators as part of a public corruption probe. Now, the prosecutor's office confirmed that Kaneshiro stopped by the office three times in the last week, believed to be in part of an effort to retrieve personal items. Now, the AG issued a statement making clear it would not be appropriate for Kaneshiro to return to the office while on leave. Attorney Keith Kiyuchi, whose client Tracy Yoshimura is leading the move to impeach Kaneshiro, says he plans to file an updated impeachment petition with the court, calling for Kaneshiro's permanent removal by the end of next week.
The judge set a deadline for us to file a first amended complaint, and then he said, you know, potentially we could have a full day hearing on April 30. So we're in the process of gathering hard copy signatures. The problem is now you have a acting prosecutor who wasn't elected by the people, and I think the prosecutor needs to be elected by the people, and I think that's an important difference. But also, there's also the question or the danger of what influence does he still have with the office, which is why proceeding with the impeachment to permanently remove him is a good idea.
The big question everybody has right now is, you know, the necessity of continuing with this action, that this petition was never meant to be a temporary solution. It provides a permanent solution, and the acts or the failures that were alleged in the petition are acts that have already happened and aren't remedied by his decision to take a leave of absence.
That was Tracy Yoshimura, who wants to impeach Kaneshiro. Now, also at this week's court hearing, Kaneshiro's lawyer, Bill McCorriston.
The real practical problem was the fact that Police Chief Ballard, unfortunately, isn't honoring the principle of innocent until proven guilty and the presumption of innocence, and did not choose to meet with us about the protocols we had in place for Mr. Kaneshiro not to involve himself in anything that might be viewed as a conflict of interest. And since she's just taken what we think is an unreasonable unilateral position that she doesn't want to work with Mr. Kaneshiro, Mr. Kaneshiro came to the reluctant decision that in the interest of the administration of justice that he should take leave so that other parts of his office won't be negatively affected.
It was only last Friday that the Honolulu City Council voted with reservations to approve paying McCorriston as Kaneshiro's attorney in this impeachment action. Now, despite a call to have the full discussion in an open forum, the City Council debated behind closed doors leading up to that vote. But here's how it was explained in an open session between Council Chairwoman Ann Kobayashi and Councilmember Carol Fukunaga.
Yes, Councilmember Fukunaga.
Thank you, Chair. You know, I note that during the Executive Matters and Legal Affairs Committee's discussion with the Corporation Council, quite a few concerns were raised on this particular matter. However, since many of the points that are raised by Corporation Council are often not able to be provided publicly, I did want to kind of highlight a couple of points that were raised that I think are important for us to discuss among council members. The Corporation Council has advised the council members that under the duties and obligations of the council under the revised charter, the City Council really must provide funds to retain a special outside legal counsel to represent Mr. Kaneshiro in this case. The following is some of the basis upon which the council will take action. Section 5-203 of the revised ordinances states that the Corporation Council is the chief legal advisor and representative of all city agencies, officers, and employees in matters relating to their official powers and duties. It also states that Corporation Council alone determines whether a matter relates to a city employee's official's powers and duties. The Corporation Council has determined that based on the allegations in the impeachment case, Mr. Kaneshiro's actions fall within the course and scope of his employment as the prosecuting attorney. He is therefore entitled to legal representation from the Corporation Council. However, because the Corporation Council is representing the city in other lawsuits in which the city's interests may be in direct conflict to Mr. Kaneshiro's interests, Corporation Council cannot represent both the city and Mr. Kaneshiro. Section 5-204 of the revised ordinances provides that where the Corporation Council has been disqualified from representing a city employee in these matters, special counsel may be retained for the city employee, and the city shall appropriate the necessary funds for such legal services. That section also states that the Corporation Council must continue to represent the city, and special counsel must be retained for Mr. Kaneshiro and funds authorized to pay the special counsel by the city council. And for those reasons, the Executive Matters Committee has reported out this matter, and it's on the council agenda for action today. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Councilmember Fukunaga. It's very hard for us to vote for this, but it's even more difficult to shirk our responsibilities, especially at the request of Corp Counsel.
Lots of hand-wringing over the decision. This particular resolution passed with two no votes from Councilmember Kim Pine and Heidi Sunayoshi. Councilmembers Ikaika Anderson and Ron Minor were said to be off-island. Overcrowding at Maui's jailhouse proved to be too much for inmates who rioted and damaged the correctional center. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Blaze Level on the line with us this morning with the latest developments about the transfer of some of those prisoners. Morning.
Morning. Great to be back on the show with you.
Yeah, quite a reality check. We understand that some of the troublemakers have been transferred over here to Oahu.
They have been. It is a reality check, and it kind of brings into focus this problem of overcrowding in Hawaii's jails and prisons. These 21 inmates who caused the trouble, they're pretrial detainees, so that means they haven't been convicted of a crime yet. They're still awaiting trial, and that population of people in jails, it makes up almost about half of those in the jail. So without them, most of the jails wouldn't be overcrowded.
Yeah, I know over the years, a lot of the Maui lawmakers have been really pushing for funding for the Maui prisons over there just because of this overcrowding situation.
Yes, they have been. In fact, the legislature is pushing several reform measures again this year. Unfortunately, A lot of the measures proposed have since died. Lawmakers were looking at bills that propose comprehensive bail reform, pretrial reform, even eliminating our use of private prisons. You know, there's that prison in Arizona where we house over 1,400 of our inmates. They wanted to cut that out, but it doesn't look like that will be happening this year.
Now, I know that lots of groups have been very concerned about this overcrowding situation, including the ACLU.
The ACLU is one of them, and they've been concerned for years. In fact, they got the federal government to issue a consent decree in the early 80s to limit overcrowding. I think that consent decree might have expired in the 90s, but they did file a complaint with the DOJ in 2017 or thereabouts to try to address that issue, but there's been no word on what the feds are doing yet.
So this movement of the troublemakers from Maui, I mean, that's just a temporary fix, though, isn't it?
It is a temporary fix for a problem that looks like it's been going on for decades, and it really doesn't look like there could be a solution coming anytime soon, given that many of these measures that lawmakers were proposing have gone away. There's several others still alive in the legislature that could propose different reforms to the bail system, but nothing as comprehensive as what some of the lawmakers were hoping to have.
Well, hopefully things settle down. I know they've got to get those modules back up in ship shape before they can send people back home to Maui.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Blaise.
Thank you so much.
That was reporter Blaise Lovell with today's reality check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Wealth Jar, Kaiser Permanente, and PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
It's been a week since officials with Argosy University announced plans to shut down its campuses across the country. HPR's Ryan Finnerty joins us with an update on where things stand with regulators and the now former students and staff. Morning.
Morning, Catherine.
So what's the latest?
Well, so Catherine, just to do a quick recap, Argosy University was a nationwide network of for-profit colleges, 22 campuses nationwide, and they officially closed last Friday, March 8th. And that was following a long court battle. There were issues with the company's finances. It came to light that they owed about $13 million in federal funds that were supposed to be given to students in the form of financial aid that were never distributed. And so in February, the Department of Education announced that they would no longer be granting financial aid to Argosy, and that kind of set the university into a death spiral. And so students and faculty both got very short notice last Wednesday that they would be closing on Friday. So less than three full days to kind of completely adjust their lives. About 800 students in Hawaii on three campuses, one in Honolulu, one in Wailuku, and one in Hilo, and just under 50 staff members, faculty and administrative. And one of those staff members is Bob Leahy. He was a professor at Argosy, and I spoke with him yesterday, and here's what he said.
We filled a niche that I think is kind of an underserved market here in Hawaii, and that was pretty much adult education. You know, the vast majority of our classes were from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., certainly all the undergraduate classes. And then some of the graduate programs had weekend classes, so they accommodated working students. The sense I got from students was our course offerings were more amenable to their schedules than some of the other schools.
So there was this was a big problem for a lot of students and faculty as well. And as Bob Leahy mentioned, a lot of these students were working. They were part-time students. Argosy did a lot of online courses or weekends and nights, as he mentioned. And Bob, by the way, was a lawyer, and he taught criminal justice and business law at Argosy. He used that job as his primary source of income, and he's now looking at having to relocate to the mainland.
Wow.
He said a lot of professors at Argosy were using, they were what's called adjunct faculty, so they weren't full-time. They would teach on the side. So he said there aren't a lot of concerns with unemployment now, but a lot of those professors did use that to supplement their income, and it was very important to them.
And I did talk to a professor who I think had been laid off when Heald College shut down, and then this was another thing. So I'm sure there were a number of lecturers there that, you know, this is the second whammy for them.
Yeah, and, you know, there aren't a lot of universities and colleges here in Hawaii, so there will be somewhat limited opportunity for people to kind of find a new job doing the same thing. This is also a huge problem for students. Many of this university shut down mid-semester, so many students are now faced with the prospect of having to transfer to another school. They don't know how many of their credits will transfer, where they'll be able to get accepted. Some of them are going to have to relocate to the mainland potentially. Many of the local universities here, UH, Manoa, Chaminade, HPU, reached out to students to try and help them, but some of them are not sure if they may have to repeat entire years of school. And here's one student who's also a veteran talking about that.
A lot of us are living off this post 9/11 GI Bill. That's how my roommate is making his only income. So, yeah, our lease isn't up until July, and we're not going to be able to start a new school until May. So, I mean, for the month of April, I don't know what's going to happen. So I'm going to try to apply at the University of Hawaii Manoa and just hope they take as much credit as I can take. But, you know, it kind of like ruined a couple of other plans. I was planning on applying for graduate school and stuff for fall of this year. And I'm moving to the mainland in July, so I kind of have to switch everything up now. I literally have 6 credits left to graduate. I don't think they're going to take the full 114. I think I have to take at least 30 credits on campus. So that's going to take another 2 semesters.
That's
probably
a full year.
A full year.
What a shame.
So, and this was a recurring concern for students, Catherine, was not just completing their education, but the financial aspect of it. So there were a lot of military students at Argosy. The Department of Veterans Affairs had said if the school closed, payments on the GI Bill would stop. And so the GI Bill, for those who don't know, is a program to fund college tuition for veterans. They also get a housing stipend. So many of them, as Jamie mentioned, are relying on that just to pay their monthly living expenses. And there is a process by which they can apply for a hardship waiver to have those continue, but it's handled on a case-by-case basis. And that university is officially closed now, so there are veterans out there that are potentially in a tough spot. Student loans for non-veteran students were also a big issue. The Department of Education has said that it will forgive loans for this semester for any Argosy students, and that will be done automatically. And for any students that transfer, whatever credits are accepted by their new university, those loans they'll still be responsible for. Any credits that don't transfer, those loans can be forgiven by the Department of Education, but you have to apply for them. One particular area of Argosy, one department, has really gotten a lot of attention, and that's the doctoral psychology program. This is one of only 2 in Hawaii, the other one's at UH, that produces PhD-level psychologists. And that's significant because that's the level you need to obtain to practice psychology on your own the way a doctor would. And there were a lot of concerns, a lot of students who – this is a long program, about 6 years that it can take to complete this. And there were dozens of students faced with potentially having to start the whole thing over. And here's one of those students right now.
People are freaking out because there's some people who are military dependent, so like their spouses got transferred out here just so they could finish the degree or what have you, so they're kind of locked into here, so it's harder for them to just go away and do a program elsewhere. So it's the people who really have to be in somewhere and getting classwork done that are really the problem. So there's people freaking out because they don't know if they're going to have to move, they don't know if they're going to be like online, they don't know if they're just going to start over. I know some people are talking about like if they have to transfer everything, they're just going to stop. So some people have their master's already, so they're willing to just work with that and just not get a doctorate. So it's kind of, they're just kind of waiting. So there's a lot of stress and panic, kind of. So nobody really knows what's going to happen. And there's nobody who is in a position to tell us what's going to happen knows what's going to happen either.
And that was Zena Ewing, who is about to start her internship, which is kind of the last stage of the doctoral psychology program, which was fortunate for her. She'll be able to continue with a university on the mainland that can sponsor her. Now, for those other students that were less far along in the program, it was looking potentially like they would have to start over. But there is some good news to report. Both Hawaii Pacific University and Chaminade University have indicated that they would like to acquire this program at Argosy. Chaminade, I just spoke with the president of Chaminade University, and that hasn't been made public anywhere else, so we're hearing it for the first time. But they're both working with regulators and accreditors to acquire the program. They expect to know sometime next week where it will go, and I'm told that the Argosy faculty in that program will have some say as to which university they land at.
Well, good. A little bit of a good news.
Yeah, for once.
All right. Well, thanks for keeping on top of this.
Sure thing.
We've been talking with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about Argosy University and the efforts of other schools as they try to fill the void. Former Argosy students seeking information should consult the Hawaii Post-Secondary Education Authorization Program website. Today we asked you to name the two species of ghost crabs found in Hawaii. Both are known in Hawaiian as ohiki. Now, the horn-eyed ghost crab and the pallid ghost crab are regular inhabitants of Hawaii's beaches. The horn-eyed variety is more abundant and larger in size, reaching 3 inches across at maturity. Pallid ghost crabs are a third of that size. Both species live in holes in the sand but prefer different locations. Pallid ghost crabs like holes dug up high on the beach, typically with displaced sand fanned out around the opening. And horn-eyed crabs dig their holes near the surf line with neat cone-shaped sand piles. The reason for the different home styles is simply based on anatomy. The larger horn-eyed crab has the ability to shovel and carry sand with its large front claw, unlike the pallid crab, which toss sand to create that fan pattern shape. Now, no winners today, but that was our quiz. And if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. In our Hawaii Garden and Forest segment, we take you out on the grounds of Bishop Museum at Kapalama. Now, the Hawaii Tourism Authority is helping to fund programs that are helping to keep the Hawaii Biological Survey up to date. Now, that's really an inventory of plants found across the state. And as part of the outreach, museum staff are restarting tours of the native gardens on the Kapalama campus that were planted almost a decade ago. We went along on last month's inaugural tour led by research specialist Clyde Imada, who's been at the museum for 35 years.
This is the sand dune area. It's covered over there. So there's been an evolution over time of this garden. But the intent was to showcase some of the plants that would grow in a habitat like this. This area, Kalihi, is a hot, dry place. Windy, rocky. In fact, these buildings were built from rock that was mined right here on the ground. All of this is basalt that was mined from this rocky habitat right here, that building too. So you can see how hot and dry and rocky it must have been. So the plants that were planted were ideally plants that would survive on their own in this kind of habitat. And over the years, there's been a number of casualties. They just proved that they cannot grow in this kind of habitat, and so we just said, okay, thank you, we won't plant you anymore.
And we sat down with Clyde Imada and the Botany Department's Collections Manager, Barb Kennedy, to dig down on the rich resource at the museum.
We have a herbarium with the largest Hawaiian collection in the world. We have over 700,000 plant records, Hawaiian and Pacific focused.
Now, we were just out in the collections area, and you had a whole table full of wonderful specimens that have been preserved for eons. Is that right?
That's correct. We have the oldest Hawaiian collections here at the museum are from Captain Cook's third voyage. So they were brought back to Britain, and we got the duplicate specimens from British Museum. So for us, that's gold. In Britain, they had people exploring all over the world on those voyages, bringing specimens back. So the Hawaiian specimens for them was just another voyage, but gold for Hawaii.
And so a lot of folks maybe don't realize the treasures that you have hidden here, because only a certain portion of it gets on exhibit or on display at any one time.
No, I hear that all the time. I go to the doctor's office or friends that I know, they will tell me they had no idea the extent of the natural history collections that we have at Bishop Museum. And we are a go-to herbarium. We have researchers that come here from all over the world and work on things like East Polynesian flora, flora of Samoa. We have a very significant Fijian collection, and they come here to do their research. And that's important to us, because what they do when they look at the specimens is they'll do what we call annotate them, or they'll put a name on it. And if they're the specialist for a certain group of plant families or genera or species, and they put their name on the specimen, we know that it's properly named. And that's important because we do use the collection for, say, plant identification. So you want to have confidence in the name of your plant specimens. We also use our collection for things like checklists, which I think Clyde could tell you more about.
You know, the museum, of course, has a storied history since 1889, basically, when it opened, of exploring the natural world. And since then, you know, it's been the go-to institution in the state for doing this kind of work. And to this day, you know, we continue to try to spread the word and take care of all of the specimens and all that. In 1992, because of all of the work we'd been doing, the state legislature declared us the Hawaii Biological Survey. To that end, we're supposed to continue to inventory all of the biota in the state and just keep records, continuous records of what is in the state, both native and non-native. And that's what we do here in botany, for instance. We continue to keep track of everything that comes into the state. We try to make sure it's identified. If something different comes in that nobody knows, we try to get it identified, because it could be a critically invasive species that nobody knows about. Once you put the name on it, you can figure out what it does elsewhere in the world, and manage it that way. So we play a critical role that way. We're sort of the go-to place for having people bring specimens in so that they can have them properly identified. Then they can go and manage them after that.
The idea is we want to know what's in our backyard.
Exactly.
We've got hitchhikers. Or
we collaborate with, say, Hawaii Invasive Species Committee, HISC, and we have funding from them, and that's part of the funding for that is to maintain the checklist that Clyde makes for all the invasive species coming in. So the importance of properly identifying things, for example, would be if you're going to do some sort of biocontrol. If you got the wrong name on that species, then you're going to be barking up the wrong tree and spending money on something that may not work. So you need to be sure it's ID'd properly.
We're just kind of maintaining the collection right now, and if we need expert identification, we'll ask experts elsewhere if they can chime in and tell us what they think something is that we haven't been able to figure out ourselves.
Which we do all the time, because a botanist is only going to specialize in either a family, a genus, maybe a geographic location. So there's a whole network of scientists all over the world that we're in contact with. And it's really great these days because we're focusing on the digitization of our collections. So everything's being data entered. That's the label data. So a herbarium specimen is a pressed and dried plant record. And it's used for scientific research and historical value. And so you have collections from, say, Captain Cook's third voyage, and collections are being made all the way up to present day. So then you send these specimens out on loan, or these days with digitization, all I have to do is send a picture or a spreadsheet. And I get questions from scientists all over the world about a certain species, and I can send them a spreadsheet or a picture. And one example of the digitization is we have our type specimens, which is... they're the most important records we have. When you name a plant species, you have to publish it. And you have to pick one specimen that you describe, and that becomes the anchor to that plant name that you publish. And throughout history, all of those special records were going back to Europe when they were traveling all over the world making collections. So by digitizing these and putting the images up online, people all over the world have access to that information because it can be really important to travel.
Now, what about storage? Because if you're continuing to maintain the collection and adding to it, there's probably a finite limit to what you can do.
Oh, there certainly is. We're not there yet. We still have room. And when I first began working here over 20 years ago, one push was to take our duplicate material and distribute it to other herbaria. And it's important when you do that, we, of course, create more room in our collection, but you're also kind of dividing those specimens up. If there's some, you know, like we have specimens in the herbarium that are burned all the way around the edges, and they were from Berlin Herbarium. In Berlin during World War II, it was bombed. So I was really excited one day when I found this specimen that was burned all the way around. Oh my gosh, this thing's burned. And they're like, yeah, that's Berlin, World War II. It was like old news to other people. For me, it was exciting.
Yeah, because it's a bit of history. It's...
So if you distribute those specimens and you have them in different herbaria, if they get lost in shipment or if something happens to a herbarium, thankfully that didn't happen in Brazil. The herbarium was saved. But you know that whole museum that burned down, that's a loss. You lose everything. So when you have duplicate specimens and distribute them, it's safer.
So were we able to do that in Brazil's case, or are they still recovering from that?
The herbarium was fine. It was in a different building. But we didn't know that right away. I think I didn't learn that for a couple days. It was really, that was an awful time when that happened.
It was, because I think everybody just gasped, thinking, oh my gosh, are all our treasures safe? Are we doing enough to safeguard what we've got in our file drawers? Or
Absolutely. And you know, we're the caretakers of these collections, and we're doing it for the state of Hawaii. We have to be really careful what we do. We do pest management all the time. You also have to manage how many people you can expose the collection to. I can't have a group of, say, 80 students walk through here on a given day because it's not safe for the collections. So you're always balancing the need to share our collections with the public and also the need to keep them safe.
And so you have this incredible collection from throughout the Pacific. You also have some specimens from Rapa Nui in this exhibit.
We do, and the Rapa Nui exhibit's up until May 5th, and the botanical specimens we have there are some canoe plants like u'ala, which is sweet potato, and taro, and what's the other one, Clyde?
The wauke.
Wauke.
Although they call it something different.
Oh, but we also have an extinct tree in the exhibit, not the whole tree, a herbarium specimen, and it's called Toro Miro. And it's extinct in the wild. It's only now found in cultivation, but it was a really important plant in Rapa Nui. They used it for wood carving and things like that.
And because they've had challenges with erosion and all of that, that it's just kind of a history, I guess, that we're tracking as to what was lost.
It was exciting that I actually found, we have two specimens of that, you know, and I thought that was pretty exciting. I didn't know that I would actually find one in the collection.
So we had it here. It wasn't like they brought it over from Rapa Nui.
No, we had it in our collection. It was collected, don't quote me, maybe in the 1930s, something like that. We have collections spanning from Captain Cook's time to present.
And so then tell us, today we've got a tour of the garden on premises here on campus. What's that all about?
Bishop Museum got a grant from the Hawaii Tourism Authority recently. And as part of that grant, we'll be updating a specimen checklist for the flies of the Hawaiian Islands and the ferns of the Hawaiian Islands. And so going along with that, the Hawaii Tourism Authority wanted more outreach relating to those two groups. And so what we're doing is we're creating several posters that will be in our Science Adventure Center, six altogether, three of flies, three of ferns. And we'll also be publishing articles in our newsletter, Ka'elele newsletter, on flies and ferns. And another component is that we've agreed to restart a garden tour that we had been doing, but we had stopped doing. And we're going to be doing this calendar year 11 tours, one a month, starting today. And it's basically
day of the second month.
And basically, you know, the garden itself. If you haven't been there, it's sort of a microcosm of the plants that the Polynesians brought, what we call the canoe plants, and also a section of the strand vegetation, the plants that they would have seen along the coast, the native plants, and the dry forest vegetation that they would have come across in the uplands.
And so these gardens, have they been basically maintained throughout the years? I mean, I don't know when you last had a
garden was installed with federal funding in 2010, and we've been maintaining it since then with a small core of volunteers.
So prior to 2010, it wasn't...
Prior to 2010, it didn't exist. There have been other gardens that have appeared and disappeared on campus because of, you know, renovations and things, but this was the last effort to create a garden that would interact with the tourists and show the linkage between cultural specimens in the collections and the living plants that they came from. And it was also the hope of the designer. His name was Leland Miano. He's a local landscape architect, to show the visitor, and especially the locals, what you can grow in this kind of habitat, what will grow naturally that's native.
And this weekend, staff will hold two garden tours as part of the Science Discovery Day on March 17th. That happens to be St. Patty's Day, so get your green on and get out in the garden. The program will spotlight Hawaii's flies and ferns, and there'll be activities for the kids in the garden that day. That's it for this week. Coming up on Monday, a call-in show about the plans to increase the capacity of the Alawai Canal for flood control. We're revisiting the issue as Valley residents push back over the construction of basins and the condemnation of private property. We'd like to hear from you. Call or talk back line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR. Or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. And if you want to hear today's show again, go to our conversation page on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up The Conversation.